This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's really time to kind of shake ourselves out of a lot of the habits that we've fallen into, read a lot of history, go talk to people who you don't normally talk to, and let's start getting organized around a vision that can actually win a majority of the votes in this country.
This week on Sea Change Radio, in the second half of my discussion with former senior advisors to the Bernie Sanders campaign, Becky Bond and Zach Exley, your intrepid host struggles with the harsh reality of an incoming president completely unqualified and unprepared to lead the planet's only superpower. We recap the 2016 presidential election and draw parallels between the fight to improve this country's healthcare system and the battle to cut carbon emissions. Then we revisit part of my discussion with Ralph Steadman, the British artist best known for his work with the godfather of gonzo journalism himself, the legendary Hunter S. Thompson. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Becky Bond and Zach Exley. They both are former senior advisors for the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. Zach, Becky, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Oh, thanks for having us on, Alex.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
When we talk about these big vision ideas, we often think about a Congress and a political environment that is not completely toxic. We think of the Tip O'Neills working with the Reagan administration. We think of bipartisan projects where the country is actually on the same page. Pretty depressing to think from a politician's standpoint. Let's say Obama had embarked on a very aggressive climate change policy. And yes, maybe he would have won more seats. But now, under this new reality of a Trump presidency, all of that could be scaled back, similar to what we're seeing in healthcare. So it seems like the toxic bipartisanship limits a politician from being able to really look beyond their 4 to 8 year administration.
You know, I think what this election showed is that this country is not breaking down along Democrat and Republican lines, but that it's breaking down along there's the 1% and the elites. And then there's everybody else who's getting screwed. And I think that the idea that that we can't actually come together around policy solutions that actually solve the problems that we face is something that's manufactured by people in Washington, D.C. That are not getting the job done and are just making excuses. And I think that if we just look at healthcare, you know, the Affordable Care Act and the Obamacare that was created at great political capital with a huge amount of work to create this really complicated process with all these state exchanges and all these online signups and all these organizations to track people down to get them to sign up just to help the big pharmaceutical and insurance companies help them sell their corporate wares. You know, it simply didn't work, right? We pursued an incremental and overly complicated solution that didn't actually solve people's problems.
Well, it did insure millions of people, so.
Okay, but let's talk about this, Alex. I think this is really important. So let's talk about healthcare, right? An incremental solution that helps people buy insurance, right, creates the situation where some people, and this is very important, people with pre-existing conditions can now get coverage at a high cost, right? And some people can keep their kids on until they're 26. But we met people every day on the campaign trail who were forced to buy Obamacare, but they bought it at such a high deductible that they couldn't go to the doctor, right? And this is why the nurses supported Bernie. What if instead of actually creating this hugely complicated bureaucracy around actually not giving healthcare to a lot of people, we just started saying, okay, we're going to let everybody sign up for Medicare. It's there, it works, it's not that complicated. We already have a bureaucracy for it, right? And it's the same thing with climate, right? I mean, I have to say, people talk about, you know, these radical visions for dealing with climate as if it's so crazy that people would actually want to solve the problem, because we all know that an incremental approach to solving climate change is just not going to work, because by the time we get around to fixing things, it's going to be too late. We'll be past the point of no return. So the only, as far as I'm concerned, the only practical policy ideas are the ones that actually solve the problem. And if a lot of people have branded those policy solutions as radical, that's their problem, because those of us who are pursuing those policy solutions, we're the only practical people. Because in the end, if we don't solve the climate crisis soon, right, if we don't actually start giving people access to healthcare instead of access to insurance that they can't use, we're not doing anything.
I completely agree. And when you think about healthcare, 2009, 2010, there was that fear from the Republicans that this was a Trojan horse, socialized medicine, that this was Medicare for all. But what would be so bad about that? Why do we have to give a soft sell to the American people on what really what they want? They don't want insurance. They want healthcare coverage.
Yeah.
So if you're a listener of Sea Change Radio and you want to get off the floor and start reinventing yourself as an activist on environmental issues in the shadow of a Trump administration, what would be on your to-do list? What are some of the things that people can do to get involved?
Well, the first thing that I would say is that I think that you should actually pick up a copy of our book, Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. And I say that not because we want to sell books, and if they're proceeds from the royalties, we're plowing that back into a nonprofit to promote organizing. But because, you know, what Zach and I learned on the Bernie Sanders campaign, usually after these presidential campaigns, people start consulting companies and start, you know, charging high fees in order to tell people how to do this kind of organizing. And instead, we decided to write down the lessons in this book so that we could share it with everybody and that everybody could have a chance to learn about it. And I think if you read the book, you're going to see that there are really simple things that people can do to get started. And people, they don't just want to talk about this stuff, they want to get to work. And so a few things people could do right now. The first thing people have to do is show solidarity with the people that are the most at risk. And that includes our neighbors who are being threatened with being deported. It includes our Muslim brothers and sisters who are being threatened with violence and being put on a registry. So there are active acts of solidarity that people can get involved in right now. And when you get together with people at a march or et cetera, make a list of the people that you know or that you're meeting for the first time. Take a clipboard and then invite people who want to get together to do some work. Invite them to a meeting and then have that meeting and then set out some goals based on where you live or what you care the most about that's actually going to be part of a larger strategy for change. And there's so many things people can do to throw sand in the gear of the fossil fuel companies right now, but it all starts with people finding each other, getting together in person, and also aligning themselves not just in the climate struggle, but in all of the rights struggles that we have before us, which we'll need if we're going to truly oppose the Donald Trump administration and start to rebuild a movement that's big enough to take power.
One of the problems with saying, you know, buy the book and listen to it, I think that was one of the things that Hillary Clinton did wrong in the debates. She kept saying, like, go to my website and read the stuff. You know, it's like, no, you got to give people action items right now if they're listening. So somebody's driving in a car right now and they're ready to jump back into the game and do something to make a positive change for the environment or any other political issue that they're passionate about. What would you recommend they do?
Again, I feel like sort of people might be a little disappointed with this answer, but I really think that we need to build power to take power, and I think there's going to be a lot of protests for the next 4 years, and you know, it's always good for people to go out and get involved, but we actually need to win elections and take power. Now, I know that a lot of people,
are they mutually exclusive?
No, they're not mutually exclusive, but I sort of have no doubt that we're going to have plenty of protests.
Yeah, because there were lots of protests in the late 60s, but Richard Nixon won in 72 by a big landslide.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm rereading Nixonland now, actually, in honor of this moment, and Rick Perlstein's book, and it's fascinating. And actually, I mean, but I think that we need to actually build power and by winning elections. And I know that a lot of people who are progressives, a lot of young people especially, I think when they hear that, they think compromise, you know, because that's what they've been seeing our politicians do, like we just discussed with Obama and Clinton. But it's the exact opposite. What we need to do is stand up on a program that actually is going to be fantastic for the American people and that 100% embraces and does not back away from our shared vision of America as a multiracial, multiethnic place, right? And that totally says no to racism, xenophobia, and misogyny, right? And so people are just used to thinking that, oh, okay, you want to talk about elections. The way we're going to win is we're going to have to, you know, not say anything, that might anger some people whose minds are primarily organized around racism and a fear or hatred of immigrants, right? And that's kind of, you know, what we've seen in a lot of Democratic politicians for a long time. So then, of course, this guy who comes out and Trump, who doesn't worry for 1 minute about offending people who disagree with him, and instead mobilizes his base. And his base is tiny. But because on the Democratic side, the vision has gotten so small that, you know, Trump was able to kind of sucker punch the establishment, with the way our electoral colleges laid out. And he was able to flip just a handful of counties in a few Rust Belt states. And that's what it took to get him in there. We're all sort of torn between these two impulses. One is to say, well, Trump didn't really win because, look, he didn't even get a majority of votes. Clinton got almost 3 million more votes. And that's true, and we have to stay focused on that and think about how few votes Trump got. You know, 25% of adults voted for Trump.
It's pretty stunning when you think about it.
Yeah. But then, on the other hand, we need to think about how he shouldn't have had any chance at all, because he was so out there and so crazy and just doing so many things to sabotage his campaign every single day. And so many people that would have liked to vote for him didn't. And he had this one piece of his message that mobilized a lot of people that, despite everything else, they came out and they voted, especially in those Rust Belt counties. These were counties that voted for Obama in 08 and in 12. And then they came out and voted for Trump because they're just so mad about losing jobs and losing their whole means of making a living and losing it forever. And so when Trump screamed and yelled about that, they said, okay, I'm going to give this guy my vote just to spite the establishment who managed the decline of our communities. And so the way to start winning is to get out there with a message that really tells everybody in America, in every community, how we're going to rebuild their economy and how we're going to change all the other stuff that needs to be changed that's really destroying our communities. Because it's not just about economics, it's also about our, you know, totally malicious and terrifying criminal justice system, which is destroying communities in a million different ways. And it's about people who care about climate change and who really want to see our economy be rebuilt along in environmental lines as well. So we need to build a vision around that's big and that calls people to action to actually transform this country. And we also need to get out of, you know, what some of us are stuck in. I'll speak for myself only and some of the people who I know. I don't want to make any blanket statements, but a lot of us are stuck in kind of a countercultural loop where when we try to talk about policies and programs, a huge chunk of the American people has no idea what we're talking about because we're using acronyms and we're using names for stuff that they've never heard before. And our ideas actually make great sense and they're right. But too often we found that, you know, we've gone off and just become a part of this countercultural, or I should say subculture, you know, that people just really can't see into. So we got to get out of that. It's really time to kind of shake ourselves out of a lot of the habits that we've fallen into, read a lot of history, go talk to people who you don't normally talk to, and let's start getting organized around a vision that can actually win a majority of the votes in this country.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Becky Bond and Zach Exley. They're former senior advisors to Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. I think this election wasn't as much about issues as much it was an unprecedented clash of two celebrities, to use, I can't think of another word. Although Hillary Clinton is a longtime public servant, most people who were voting just had just thought of her as somebody who's been around for a long time, and Americans don't like royalty. They don't like to be told this is who they're supposed to be voting for. And she won more of the popular vote, but if you look at qualifications, it shouldn't have even been close. So you have to look at personality and biases beforehand. And that was one of the arguments that I made in the primaries to my friends who thought Clinton was a more pragmatic choice than Bernie Sanders. I said, whether or not it's rational, there is a large swath of the American electorate that does not like Hillary Clinton for whatever reason, and you're not going to convince some of those people to vote for her. I think we're talking about low information voters who couldn't care less about policy, or they would never have voted for this man who never put out any policies.
Actually, no. I mean, I really do want to disagree with that. If you watch his speeches that he gave in these stadiums like three times a day all over those Rust Belt states, he talked about jobs in very concrete terms. And people understand Clinton as being a member of the establishment, and even these low information voters who the one thing that they knew and that they were right about was that Clinton was part of an establishment that had deindustrialized America. And they let that happen, and people lived that, and they saw that happen, and they saw generations of politicians, Democratic and Republican, just not say anything about it, and just say, yeah, you know, we can't hang on to those old timey jobs, you know, making steel and stuff like that. And so they really understood what Clinton represented, and then Trump came in there and gave voice to that.
I see what you're saying, and I do agree in terms of he was on message with that point. But I think ultimately there was a larger swath of the electorate that was just picking two celebrities. It could have been Jay-Z versus Beyonce.
Yeah, it was also people voting on by party lines, right? I mean, I live in a very red area in a very deeply conservative town.
You're in Arkansas?
I'm in southwestern Missouri. And a lot of people around here were mostly for Cruz or Ben Carson.
That must have been great going to the store for you all the time.
Hey, that's why I'm here, you know, trying to get out of that bubble and trying to communicate with the other side. But, you know, most people around here also voted for Trump, and they were not happy to vote for Trump, but they voted for a Republican.
That was their team.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I mean, it's the same reason why a lot of people voted for Clinton, even though they really didn't like her. And so, you know, you got these two choices. And if you think that the Democrats are like evil incarnate, you know, then you're going to vote for the Republican if these are the only two choices. The other thing is, I do agree that people were very low information in a lot of ways. And I was amazed, you know, like when the tapes came out, you know, when the groping tapes came out where you could hear Trump confessing and bragging about sexual assault. And so I thought, well, this is it. It's done.
How many of those did we have though, right?
I know. But no, but here's the thing is a lot of people never heard the tapes, and they never heard about them. And I know that seems impossible, right? But it's true. And I over and over I asked people, you know, well, surely this is gonna, you know, prevent you from voting. And they were like, well, what are you talking about? And then they were like, oh, you mean, yeah, I heard he said something bad or something, whatever. And I said, no, you can hear him confessing to assaulting women, bragging. And they were like, really? Wait a minute, really? And they hadn't absorbed that. And so I think that was part of the genius of Trump's sort of personal media operation was he just was throwing so much crazy stuff out there every single day that there was never a sustained attack, you know, like, so instead of like, let the forces all align, you know, around demanding an apology, he just kept throwing out crazier and crazier stuff. And it just was a constant like destabilization of the media narrative. So
I think you're right. I remember seeing a video of Keith Olbermann posting a huge list of why Donald Trump is not qualified to be president. But at like point 85, it was just like, okay, this has been lost. Like you have one or two reasons for voting. You don't have 80 reasons not to vote for somebody. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah, that too. But also I want to make, I do think we need to recognize that I think that a lot of people who voted for Trump would agree that Clinton was more qualified. But because Clinton represented the establishment that's been dismantling their means of making a living for 40 years, they would rather not have her as, you know, as qualified as she is. They'd rather have somebody unqualified, because to have somebody who's qualified at dismantling your means of making a living and destroying your community, you would rather not have them in there. It's not a matter of quality. You know, it's like if the job is to destroy your life, you would rather have someone unqualified sitting in that job. Let's imagine the job is executioner, right? And you have been sentenced to death. Do you want a qualified executioner or an unqualified executioner? I will please take the unqualified executioner, you know, and I would love to take the executioner who is unqualified for the job and says, you know, I don't think we should be doing any of these executions anyways, you know, and I would vote for that person, even if they were a complete idiot. So I don't know if that analogy makes sense, but I think that's actually how a lot of people were processing it. Yeah.
I hadn't thought about who I wanted to be my executioner, but I appreciate the perspective. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Becky Bond and Zach Exley. They're former senior advisors to Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. So circling back to the issue of the climate, the Obama administration has made some strides, of course. You and I may have found some of his measures to fall short, but when we look at the irrefutable danger that this incoming administration poses, I think we'll soon be pining for the days of the Obama administration.
You know, ask any person who really knows the science. I mean, we are so screwed, right? And the thing is, after 8 years of Obama, we're screwed, you know? And so I think we need to shift our thinking to a whole different mode.
And
right?
What's that? And
it's about winning. And so you have to participate in the democratic process of this country, and you have to win over a majority of the American people. Stop yelling at them. Stop talking in confusing terms. We have to win over the majority of the American people. And so however you, wherever you are, can do that, let's get working on it.
Becky Bond and Zach Exley, they're former senior advisors for the Bernie Sanders campaign, and they're the authors of Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. Becky, Zach, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
Now let's dig into the Sea Change Radio archives to hear a little snippet of my discussion with the legendary artist Ralph Steadman. So Ralph, can you walk us back to the genesis of your unlikely pairing with Hunter S. Thompson?
I think I was just waiting for the answer, the prayer to be answered. I only went to America looking for work, and I got a call. He was the art director of Scanlan's magazine, but he was the man who contacted me. He said, how would I like to meet an ex-Hell's Angel who just shaved his head? And I said, okay, that'd be fine. That's a job, is it? Is this a job? And he said, yes, you got to go to Kentucky and meet. And it took 3 days before we met. We eventually met up in Kentucky at the Derby, as you call it, the Derby, we say, and in Louisville. And we, after 3 days, I heard a voice behind me, and it was Hunter. I turned around, and there's this bullet-headed character, 6'6", a huge guy. And he said, you Ralph Steadman? I said, yes. I said, okay, I'm Hunter S. Thompson. Hello. I wonder, maybe you should get a beer. So I said, okay, let's get a beer. So we got a beer. And then he said to me, let's sit and look at the track. You know, there's races going on before the big race. And so I said, okay. And then he said, do you bet? And I said, well, I did bet on Early Mist in 1952, and then in 54, rather, in the Grand National. Oh, I see. And I won. Oh, I see. So he said, well, shall we look at the race and what's happening? And then you pick a race, pick a horse. So I said, okay. So I said, I'll have that one there, which is, I think it was Human Race, actually, was what I just picked it, you know, funny name. But and it won. He said, hey, that's fantastic. So I put a, he said, maybe you should put a real bet on, like some money, you know. So I said, okay, I'll put $1 on that one. I don't know what it was now. And it lost. And I said, that's why I don't bet. Because he asked me if I bet. And I said, had this uncertain feeling about betting because I bet without money. But if I put money on it, it's bound to lose. So just bear that in mind, would you?
I will. And one of the books that really kind of captures your friendship and life on the trail together is The Curse of Lono. Was that your first time going to Hawaii in The Curse of Lono?
Yeah.
When you think back of that trip, what shouts out at you?
In Honolulu, we were there first. And in Honolulu, I was overwhelmed by just the sheer difference of everything. The pace of life was slower and better, you know, more enjoyable and crazy. And I liked that. Lack of responsibility, lack of regulation, if you like. And so we just sort of settled into the place, and Hunter was, he was carrying with him a typewriter, you know, that's what he carried with him. I just had a sketchbook and a little camera, a little mini camera, you know, and that's how we started that thing. And the Curse of Lono, the title came from me. I thought he wanted to call it Hawaiian Diaries. And I said, no, that's a bit boring, you know. Call it The Curse of Lono, because I'd read about Lono, the god Lono from 150 years ago, 1,500 years ago, sorry. As curse was always something that Hunter loved to use. He loves cursing everything, you know, do anything without him saying, Ralph, stop that, you know. My drawing was a filthy habit, and that was it, you know. And so, but he did want drawings, you know, and secretly he was enjoying it all.
Ralph Steadman, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Did you learn anything? That's the point, Alex. Bye, Alex. All of us. Bye. Bye.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Jerry Douglas, Spinal Tap, and Booker T and the MGs. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week, as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.